Buddhist Summer School, Tuesday afternoon, 4th September 1979. Let us pick up the threads with some considerations of the second great truth which the Buddha propounded, namely the truth which states the cause of dukkha, which we commonly translate as suffering, namely tanha, craving. And yesterday we considered for a while how craving arises through the psychical attachment to pleasure, to that which is agreeable to us, either physically or mentally. And this attachment makes us desire more and more of the pleasant, and it becomes a fixation, it becomes an imposthume, a barb, a diseased state. This craving is very much associated with the greater part of our ordinary desires. Very few people examine their desires or investigate their nature. They bring to bear their intellectual faculties for fulfilling their desires. And in the case of the majority of human beings, intellect is the slave of desire. It functions in obvious ways, it functions in very subtle ways too. By subtle ways, I mean something like this. Those of us who have cultural interests, who are concerned with the pursuit of knowledge, as we call it, and so forth, identify ourselves with that and derive great personal satisfaction. Quite naturally, that is how it happens. And we bend all our intellectual abilities to serving that desire, that pursuit. We cannot, as we are, carry out that pursuit without any self-interest involved, without any vested interest. If we could, then that desire is perfectly pure and it is not binding. It doesn't, at least it doesn't tend to come to an end in terms of disappointment, grief, sorrow, etc. But otherwise, all pleasures come to an end. Pleasures as pure pleasures, sensational delights through gratifying the senses and the sense activities. If the desires or frustrated, then they give rise to violence. And so, what starts by being rooted in greed, in possessiveness, in the gratification of the pleasure drive, through frustration gives rise to violence, to hate. Greed and hate are intimately involved in a single complex. Now, associated with greed and hate, with craving and violence, are many illusions and delusions. The great delusion is that the gratification of our desires spells happiness, true permanent happiness. Perhaps the outstanding example of this in our world is the pursuit of wealth, first and foremost, and the pursuit of power. Wealth and power are the two high-ranking officials who dominate our lives, deluding us, luring us with the carrot of true happiness. This delusion clouds our perception into the real nature of ourselves and what we are doing in life. Therefore, life's purpose in each and every one of us is thwarted. And that thwarting perhaps shows mostly as the years advance and one begins to wonder, was it all worthwhile? And we wonder, was it all worthwhile, expecting to find the answer in terms of our fixed criteria and worldly values. Sometimes we inquire, what is the meaning of life? What is the purpose of life? And then in our old age there is remorse that we have failed to fulfill something which is truly worthwhile, which is sacred, which is harmless and beautiful and true and good in itself. One sees that sorrow in older people, very strongly marked. Then they turn to orthodox religion, they turned to sets of beliefs and doctrines for comfort. But usually they don't get ahead with it. They don't arrive at real perception which would rejuvenate their sad, disappointed, psyches. And so they have a feeling, well, we must somehow or other get on with it till we die and make the best of it, with little idea of the meaning of making the best of it. So you see, so we see how craving lies at the root, one of the main roots of the whole complex of sorrow in the worldly sense and in our personal lives. Now, what is the cure for this? You remember we saw yesterday that we cannot get rid of suffering and we should not get rid of it. Don't fight against it. Don't have aversion towards it. It is there. It can serve a wonderful purpose, a divine purpose. If we really care to discover the truth, to discover the truth not as a set of ideas and consolatory doctrines, because they actually are impotent ultimately, but in the sense that we become so pure in our search for it that we let the truth reveal itself to us. If the beloved is truly beloved, that beloved will reveal himself or herself to the pure lover. In that way, truth comes upon them unexpectedly, naturally, spontaneously, and here there is true happiness, not through the pursuit of craving, not through slavery to craving in any form. And this brings about the allaying, the cooling, a word the Buddha was very fond of using, cooling and cooled. The allaying of this terrible fever of desire, a burning fever of desire. It cools it down. And when that is cooled, from the inner depths of the mind, one can begin to see light, understand the true nature of things, and seeing that this indeed is the true nature of things, we let that true nature function in our lives. We do not fight against anything anymore. Nor, on the other hand, do we grasp our early perceptions of the true nature of things as, this is the truth. It isn't. Truth is infinite. For one thing, you can't grasp the infinite. And for another thing, our own personality, our own being, cannot contain the whole truth straight away, which raises up a question. You know, when a man is a witness in a law court. He swears he will tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. It is totally impossible for any ordinary living human being to do so. Absolutely impossible. The truth as he sees it, and most often as he wishes to see it. This is the trouble, not merely with the witness in the law court, but with all human beings. We wish to see truth in this, that or the other way, because it gives us pleasure. It gives us satisfaction. When intellectual curiosity functions very strongly, we are seeking answers. Now, have we noticed that what makes us accept and or reject the answers? It has to satisfy my intellect, which I like to call, and often just euphemistically, my good sense, my reason, my reasoning. That is not the case. It is because it gives me pleasure. How often we say, oh yes, I agree with that, therefore it must be true. Well, now, how does one allay the fever of desire, of craving? And here we have perhaps the real key, which the Buddha, in his terms, presented as perfect mindfulness. Perfect mindfulness. Samma sati. Samma also means right. But the word right is somewhat spineless. It's flabbergasted in this context. The Eightfold Path and the items composing that Eightfold Path, called the Middle Way and so forth, there's nothing middle about it in the sense of compromise, in the sense, the worldly sense of coming to terms with. Samā means perfect. It has to be wholly right, totally right. Why? Because the religious life is the life which is enabling us to grow towards our true human fulfillment, which lies in terms of the infinite, the eternal and the immortal. We really must appreciate that. Otherwise, we shall always be lukewarm about our religious living. We shall always be slipping back and say, oh well, it's only human to make mistakes and err and so forth. I think we would be more correct if we said, after all, it is truly subhuman to make mistakes. And the Latin humanum est errare probably would be truer to the reality if they had subhumanum est errare. Now, this perfect mindfulness, what does it imply? How are we conscious? How are we mindful of anything? By paying attention to it. Our power of paying attention is our true instrument of salvation, of salving, making healthy, whole, holy. When this instrument of salvation is used rightly and in perfection, then there is that state of health and wholeness which is holiness in the true sense of the word, the complete sense of the word, the divine sense of the word. Paying complete attention, which means not only being fully alive, fully alert with all the senses, but completely open-minded at the same time. Completely open-minded, wheresoever the truth may lead us, so that we are prepared to relinquish, completely relinquish, what is perceived as not being wholly true. Then, what we call renunciation at any level, material, psychological, aesthetic, any level, what we call renunciation, relinquishment, takes place naturally and spontaneously. And not in the sense in which most people feel, oh, I have to be a good Buddhist or a good Christian, I must renounce this. But inside there is a, oh dear, feeling about it, a loss. A loss? In fact, where there is true renunciation, not only the individual, but all humanity has gained. Because to the extent, the manner in which this relinquishment and renunciation takes place, it affects not only oneself, but it affects everything around us too. It is somewhat like this. If an inventive genius produces something which is really efficient and helpful to us in our lives, it is not he alone who benefits by it. All human beings can benefit, and many human beings do benefit by it. The whole environment benefits by it. So whatsoever good comes into being like that, naturally and spontaneously in us, is humanity's gain, is humanity's well-being and happiness. So this paying of attention in the right way, and to be observant means not merely to be on guard against what we consider evil. That means we are setting ourselves against evil. We are striving to overcome evil. The evil in the psyche cannot be overcome in the sense in which human beings understand it. If that which is evil is truly seen with the mind poised and perfectly calmly, is truly seen as evil, it naturally drops off. That is the real psychotherapy, the psychological medicine. The true seeing of our psychological condition, our state, constitutes both the diagnosis and the cure. With the body it is different. The body falls ill, we go to a doctor. Another person, he is the expert. He gives us what is called medicine. We take it, and time and again, it benefits us. It frees us from our ailment. Time and again, it doesn't also. But in the case of the psyche, you can't go to another and get a pill or in the shape of an idea or a belief or something and be healed by it. It's an idea which counteracts something, some idea which we hold. But that doesn't mean that we see truth. It is the truth that sets you free. New Testament, isn't it? The truth sets you free. And that freedom of the psyche is the healing of the psyche. And your soul strength, your virtue, functions naturally and spontaneously, just as your heart or your liver or kidney, if the body is healthy, function naturally and spontaneously. You don't have to bother about it. Now, one can spend a whole afternoon talking about perfect mindfulness, this perfect attentiveness. There is just one other point in connection with it which we should consider, and that is this. Whilst we are observing, let us not delude ourselves that our observation is purely objective, impersonal, devoid of vested interest. It isn't. It is a very wishful observation. We have to observe not only that, all the stimuli that come to us, but we have to be well aware, fully awake to all the reactions which go out from us, from our brains. Notice how we converse, how we listen to a speaker or read a book. As we are listening or reading, the brain is chattering back all the time. Now, what does the chatter consist of? What is the force behind it? Our conditioned state, our fixed ideas, beliefs, convictions, and so forth. I'm not suggesting for a moment that the ideas or the convictions are altogether false. Not at all. But surely it's a little bit of conceit to think that those convictions and beliefs and so forth are absolute truth. Therefore, notice that, realizing that one has to be open-minded, and that if one realizes that, then the intellect becomes a compassionate intellect. Then the first thrill of wisdom, the functioning of wisdom begins, because there is no such thing as wisdom by itself, as pure, cold intellect at work. It is compassionate intellect, just as there is no love, no compassion, which is all feeling without real wisdom underlying it. Wisdom to be distinguished from knowledge, mere knowledge. See? So, be aware of all these reactions. In that way, or in some similar way, and then one will be compassionate towards oneself. When we fight against evil, it is partly due to our self-hate. As long as there is any vestige of self-hate in me, I can never be free of hate against another. consider these things in relation to fanatics, to inquisitors, to those who are bent upon saving other people's souls. By force. All these things are very subtly tied up, and we have to disentangle the confused skein which we call our psychical life. We have to disentangle the whole thing and bring order into the psyche. Let order come in into the psyche. So, perfect mindfulness, it wholly cleanses the psyche of the cancer of tanha, of craving. Now, in this connection, it is very interesting to note that it is said that the Buddha, after the enlightenment, stares at the roots of the tree under which he sat for 7 days and nights. What do you feel about that? The enlightened Holy One stares at the roots of a tree. He may have botanical interests. But do you think he'll spend 7 days and nights staring at the roots of a tree after having realized that supreme, sublime, unoriginated nirvana itself? He who has stood in the presence of the supreme, who is fully aware of the fact that in that supreme we live and move and have our being, is his brain deranged a little bit afterwards that he stares at the roots of the tree? First of all, what is this tree, this Bodhi tree? Of course, the scholars have discovered it is the ficus religiosa. I won't give a fig for that. The tree is the tree of life within ourselves. Physically, materially, it is the brain and the nervous system and the whole electrochemical activity of the living body, which makes it a psychophysical unity. And you remember yesterday we considered this point: nature brings the body to maturity, but it is our personal responsibility. Nature doesn't play such any very important part here. It is our personal responsibility and duty to let the psyche come to maturity, to the state of purity, of perfect health and perfection. Now, what does the enlightenment mean? Here is the pure mind at last, functioning through a completely empty, clean, transparent psyche. Not my will, but thine, O Lord. Then that can become a reality for us. Otherwise it can't. If my psyche is full of my little clobber, how can the perfect mind, the pure mind, the universal mind, as distinct from my personal limited consciousness, function through the psyche? study the myth of Psyche and Eros. It's a wonderful thing to study. You learn an enormous amount. Meditate on it carefully. So now, this tree which is now of such a nature that the psyche is completely transparent and pure mind, this archetypal universal energy functions freely through it with no obstruction from the activity of the brain, our thinking feeling process as we ordinarily experience it. No obstruction. But this is a unique phenomenon. Who knows about it? There's not hardly, well, perhaps I shouldn't make too positive a statement, but do you think you'd find a professional psychiatrist who knows what is the pure mind, which means the utterly healed psyche? What is the function, the ordinary function of the psychologist and the psychiatrist? A worldling comes to him ill, confused, troubled, diseased. Your psychiatrist does his best for him and recirculates that worldling into a world which has been very much responsible for reducing this person to his ill state. That is why they all use the phrase, you must come to terms with the evil of the world. You cannot come to terms with the evil of the world. You cannot come to terms with the evil within the psyche. You can completely let it get transformed by the realization of truth. And then that works naturally, spontaneously, unknowingly, undeliberately, just as nature works naturally, spontaneously, and brings forth well-being and beauty and happiness, the true happiness. These things have to be borne in mind very carefully. By all means, if the situation has become intolerable, too difficult, one does need a crutch for the time being, a help. All right, go to a psychiatrist, converse with him, and let there be a healthful cleansing interplay. But bear in mind, the real responsibility rests upon you, not upon the psychiatrist. If you can fulfill your responsibility, then there will be healing. Otherwise, it will be a tranquilizing, just dope for the time being. But with perfect mindfulness, there comes the true healing. So the Buddha stares at the roots of the tree is just a symbolical way of describing that the Buddha now is concerned with understanding how this pure mind functions. And it is out of the realm of the pure mind that the concepts and the technique of living the religious life emerge. Doesn't emerge by a mere thinking process in terms of the finite, the mortal, the suffering, the ill. Doesn't arise from that. Comes from the source of all life and truth and purity. That is why purity is so important. The basis is morality. Not morality in the sense of mere customary action as laid down in the world. because that changes fashions through the ages. But the morality of human living is a morality which derives its mandate, its imperative, from transcendence itself. And there is no fixation in transcendence, no fickleness in transcendence, no fortuitousness, or no mere experimentation in the dark, no changing of fashions where God is concerned, or where the unborn, the unbecome, the unmade is concerned. We really have to brood over these things, let the mind be quiet, and let them all emerge out of the inner depths, and they will take the right form in concept and in word in your own mind, according to the degree to which you yourself have grown into reality, into truth. You cannot acquire reality or possess it. It is Lord of us. Lord in the sense of protector, nurturer, and bringer to fulfillment. The giver of the deathless, as they described the Buddha. Now, there are certain very interesting accounts regarding some of the meditations which the Buddha went through after the Enlightenment. We are all told that it was on that wonderful night that the Enlightenment took place. I think we can dismiss that Enlightenment on a particular night at a particular time. You know how things really grow. Have you watched, for example, a bud opening out? It's a process in time, and it comes in starts, and those starts represent the critical point when the forces from within that bud have reached that critical point, and suddenly there is the manifestation. This is this so-called sudden enlightenment that is spoken of. Behind it, there has been the accumulation of all the right forces, and at the right time, the right position, the right place, in the ripeness of circumstance, the impulse takes place, and lo and behold, there's the opening out, and the next one, and the next one. That is the way all energy functions also, in spurts like that. So, the night of the Enlightenment is only a convenient way of talking to represent the final critical point having been reached as the result of all that occurred in his past years bearing fruit finally. The Mahayanists talk of another enlightenment when he was 51 and propounded the full doctrine of Shunyata. So was he completely enlightened at 35 or not? You see? We have to be very careful how we read and study these things. And so, in the Mahavagga, you find it stated that he spends 7 days whilst blissfully enjoying, rather a strange way of putting it, whilst blissfully enjoying the fruits of enlightenment, he spends 7 days under the Ajapala tree meditating. Now, this word Ajapala is translated as the goat herd's banyan tree. Aja is a goat. But Aja also means the unborn. Aja, the unborn. And Pala is one who tends. A goat herd is a man who tends goats. This Ajapala tree might mean that the Buddha tended the tree of the unborn. What could it mean? The unborn, the unaging, the undying, etc., is not of this world. It's a symbolical way of representing, perhaps, that in this transcendent mode of awareness in which he entered, he was able to be in touch with the springs of creative energy and activity of a nature we just don't know, which, out of which, everything evolves, grows rightly, and comes to fruition. The rose is a perfect rose, the bird is a perfect bird, and so forth, and man as a perfect man. The Ajapala tree. Think about it. It is just a suggestion. I don't say this is the real meaning. Not at all. But he meditated for 7 days and nights under the Ajapala tree. And after 7 days of meditation, he breathes forth this cry. You know the Pali word, Udana. The inspired utterance, which fully expressed, livingly expressed, the profound truth insofar as it could be expressed in verbal form. Note what he says. The Brahman, whose nature is unsinful, not harsh, unstained, self-restrained. I should, if I may suggest, don't think of that word restraint in the ordinary sense of just restraining, preventing, compelling, or controlling. Self-restrained, self-contained as a whole, which naturally does things rightly. The Brahman whose nature is unsinful, not harsh, unstained, self-restrained, who has mastered knowledge and fully traversed the Brahma path. Now, the Pali, if I remember correctly, who has mastered knowledge, the word is Vedantagu. Veda Anta Agata. Vedantagu. Who has come to the end of the Vedas, to the end of wisdom, in whom there is the complete fruition of perfect wisdom, the Mahaprajna, as we call it, the great insight. That is to say, not an insight as we say in common parlance, but the power to see immediately the truth of things. It's an extraordinary thing. This is the crown of intellect, the pure intelligence, the nous of the Greeks, the buddhi of the Indian teachers, which sees with unerring insight the truth, just naturally and at once. You, using your eyes, will see at once that that's a picture there, here is a fireplace, and so forth. A simple, a simple fact which you need not argue with. That is just so. In that sense, Vedanta Bhu, who has come to the end of the Vedas, bear in mind the significance of this. The Buddha was not at all unacquainted with all the spiritual wisdom which preceded him. The wisdom of the Brahmanical faith, starting with the hymns of the Vedas, through the writings known as the Brahmanas, the Aranyakas, which were the forest meditations, and the last chapters of the Aranyakas form the major Upanishads, as well as some of the so-called minor Upanishads. He was well acquainted with all that. He had come to the end. So, and he says, the Brahman, whose nature is like this, was come to the end of it all, and fully traversed the Brahma path, the holy life, the path, the way which is in God, through God, to God, to use Western Christian terminology. That is the Brahma path, that is the holy life. Otherwise, when we say in Him we live and move and have our being and we talk about the omnipresence of God, we are chattering something which is untrue for us to chatter, to pronounce. Because we merely utter the words parrot-wise. You can teach a parrot to say all these things. And he will say them very accurately, you know. Now, he rightly, a Brahman in the true sense of the word, as presented in the Vajrasuchi Upanishad, that a Brahman is he, whatsoever his caste or birth or anything may be, is he who has fully realized Brahman. Now, that is a Brahman. There it is in the Vajrasuchi Upanishad. He, rightly a Brahman, may or ought to announce the Brahma word, the word of the Supreme, the word of truth. And then, as an aside, but a very important little addition, he who has no self-obtrusiveness in the world, who is truly selfless, all selfness in him has disappeared. He is no longer separate from anything. He will never obtrude upon the world, upon anybody, upon anything. how do I behave in ordinary life? Free of self-obtrusiveness or obtruding myself here, there, everywhere. I am so important, I know such a lot, I'm such a wonderful fellow. I should like to help so and so. That's only an excuse for obtruding upon the other fellow. Give help only when it is asked. When you see that the other person really feels in sympathy with you, is really needing it, then give him just enough to go on his way happily. If you give more, and I know all this from personal experience, if you give more, he will feel antagonism towards you because you'll hurt his ego. His ego, like a balloon, will start deflating. And he will not like you for that. You see? Alright, who has no self-obtrusiveness in the world? The Buddha proceeds thereafter to the what is called the Muchalinda, the Serpent King's Tree. And after 7 days of meditation, he breathes forth this cry. Blissful is the solitude of the happy one who has learnt the law and comprehends. The solitude of the happy one. You are no longer lonely when enlightened, but you are the alone. There's a tremendous distinction between those two. Loneliness involves selfness in so many ways. Self-pity, this feeling of fear, of retreating, of wanting someone to do something for you and all the rest of it. But when you are the alone, you are not self-obtrusive. You stand on your own feet, not with pride, but naturally, like the human being should stand. It's a very different situation. The alone is the one only. The one only, not in the sense of separateness, but in the sense that transcendence, God or whatever word you like, is the one only. It's the totality, the absolute, the one only. And if a man can be like that, then he is in complete harmony with the world in which he lives. Blissful is unhurtfulness in the world, self-restraint towards living things. Blissful is non-desire in the world, the transcending of sense pleasures, the putting away of the conceit, conceit meaning fancy, the imaginary thing, the unreal thing. The putting away of the conceit, I am, this indeed is the highest bliss. I think we'll stop there today and finish this off tomorrow.